Welcome to Christchurch Manchester Sermon Podcast. CCM is one church that meets every Sunday in various locations across Manchester. For more information about who we are or about our Sunday meetings, please visit www.christchurchmanchester.com.
My home is not on this earth, not in this world.
One of my favourite shows when I was growing up on TV was The Crystal Maze. Did anyone ever watch The Crystal Maze? It was brilliant. Okay, so let me just kind of describe it if you've not seen this show. You've got a team of people going around this maze. And in it, there's loads of rooms. And the rooms each have a challenge in it. So they nominate a team member to go into the room and do the challenge. And they've got like 3 minutes or 2 minutes. It varies from one to the next. And if they could achieve whatever the challenge was, they got a crystal to take back to their team. There's a whole bunch of these over the course of the show. The objective was to get as many crystals as you could, because then in the end challenge, they went inside this massive crystal. They put like the fans on. There were some bits of gold and silver paper flying around, and they had more time to collect these bits of paper based on the number of crystals they had. I'm really selling it to you, I know. But in these challenges that they had to do, sometimes they didn't get out of the room in time. Now, they could give up if they wanted. They could just say, you know what, I'm not going to do it, I'm just going to leave. But some, they were so desperate to get it done, they didn't get out of the room by the time the timer had finished. And if that happened, they were locked into the room and couldn't get out. So the person was now trapped and couldn't stay with their team going around the rest of the maze. Okay. Other challenges, if you made certain kinds of mistakes, that was an automatic lock-in. So you were locked into the room. And the only way you could get people out, and you wanted all your people out, because when you're collecting these bits of paper in the big crystal, you need as many people as you can to help you with that. But the only way you could get someone out who's been locked into a room is if you're willing to give up one of your crystals, okay? That was the cost of setting somebody free. It's a brilliant show, okay? You should watch it. It's only a UK challenge at lunchtime if ever you're around and bored. But one of the things I like about the show, actually, is it's the best illustration that I found in contemporary, I say contemporary, like 1990s culture, let's say, of the biblical idea of redemption. Okay? So redemption is a category that runs right through the Bible. And literally, redemption means setting someone free by paying a price. That's what happens in the crystal maze. When someone is locked into one of these rooms, they have to pay a price. It's their crystal. They've earned it. They've done the work, and they deserve that crystal. They have to give that up to set someone else free. That's what redemption is. And that's the theme we're going to be exploring this evening. Now, this is the last sermon in a series on the book of Ruth, and we've been looking at it over 4 weeks. And what happened so far? You had Elimelech, Naomi, Mahlon, and Chilion. They were a family who lived in Bethlehem. There was no food, so they moved to Moab in search of food. While they were there, Mahlon and Chilion, the two sons, they both married women from Moab. Elimelech, Mahlon, and Chilion all died while they were in Moab. Neither of the boys had had any kids, so there was Naomi left with her two daughters-in-law, Ruth and Orpah. Naomi decides, we're going to go back to Bethlehem now because life is tough in Moab. I've heard there's food in Bethlehem. Let's go back. But probably the best thing for these girls, for Ruth and Orpah, is to return to their family home, to go back where they'll be provided for, where they'll be their parents, their siblings can take care of them. So Naomi suggests this. Orpah says, yeah, okay, I'll do that. And she goes back to her family home. But Ruth says, no, I don't want to do that. I want to stick with you. She makes a promise. We call it a covenant, to stick with Naomi through thick and thin. So Naomi and Ruth come back to Bethlehem. Now, they didn't have a lot, and it was hard in those days for women to make a living. There weren't kind of easy jobs for them to get. But there was a law that they could avail themselves of called the law of gleanings, where basically they could go in the fields after they'd been harvested, and if there were bits dropped on the floor, or if the people hadn't gone right up to the edge, there were little bits that they could take so that they had would at least have something to eat. So Ruth, as the younger woman, she goes and does this, and she goes and she finds a field that happens to be owned by this guy called Boaz. And Boaz, he's described as a worthy man, and he conducts himself in a really gracious way to her. He sees her, he asks after her, he says, look, you don't have to stay back at a distance, you can be close to my workers, and that provides you a bit of safety and security. You're not all on your own in the field, and if you're thirsty, you can drink some of my water. And he actually told his workers to take a bit more care of the barley than they would normally drop and just drop it on the floor so she'd have plenty to pick up. So he was treating her really kindly. She gets home, she tells the story to Naomi, and Naomi is like, oh right, oh, Boaz, yeah, I know Boaz, because Boaz was a distant relative of Naomi's husband, Elimelech. And so Naomi gets a bit of an idea, and it's like, I've got a plan, Ruth. Basically, right, we're going to get you dressed up in all your nicest clothes, we'll put some perfume on, and then when he's had a few to drink, and it's kind of late at night after they've all been celebrating, and he's kind of fallen asleep on the threshing floor, just go and lie at his feet. So she does, and He wakes up, and Naomi's plan was to say to him, look, what do you want me to do? Now, Ruth doesn't do that. She said, actually, I'll tell you what I want, Boaz. I want you to spread your wing over me, which is an image of covenant relationship. It's an image of redemption, effectively, that's already been applied to God in the story of Ruth. And so Boaz is like, okay, I will do that. I want to do that, but there's a problem that relates to the law first. But the book that we've seen, really, we've looked at three relationships. The first relationship is a really important one, which is Ruth's relationship with Naomi. Okay? Second one is Boaz's relationship with Ruth. And the third one is God's relationship with his people. And all three converge around the same idea. And the idea, the word for it in the Hebrew, is hesed. And this is a particular kind of love. It's the hesed love. It means an eager and ardent desire, a zealous, committed, loving kindness. It's a covenant love. So Ruth had promised this kind of love to Naomi. This was the love that Boaz wanted to show to Ruth, and this is the love that God has for his people. So we've been thinking about it in all different dimensions. We've called the book of Ruth a story of romance and redemption, because some people teach it as though it's mainly a like romance how-to guide, and that isn't true. That's not what the book is about. But you can't deny there is a romantic thread to one of the storylines that goes through it. But also look at the horizontal relationships that are non-romantic. So say Ruth and Naomi, the way we can, as the people of God together, be committed to each other fervently, be before one another in that kind of way. And ultimately it stems from the way God is for his people with this hesed love. So all three come out of this same kind of love. But all three stories have a big loose end to them by the time we got to the end of chapter 3. Okay, none of them are resolved because for Ruth and Naomi, yes, they've come back to Israel, but life's still hard. They're still at the mercy of finding these gleanings. They've not found stability, and they certainly haven't found like Elimelech's land and lineage restored yet. For Ruth and Boaz, we know they kind of like each other, but they haven't yet got married. And we know that there's another guy who's a closer relative than Boaz, who's still a bit of a spanner in the works for that story. And actually, for God and his people, we know that this started at a tough time. There was famine in Bethlehem, which was meant to be the house of bread. So all of them, we kind of see there needs to be a redeemer. So let's pick up the first kind of track of this, which is Ruth and Boaz. So it might seem a bit odd saying, well, Ruth and Boaz like each other, but the problem is this other guy. Okay, that sounds a bit weird. Because you'd say, well, if they like each other, why don't they just kind of forget this other guy and get married? But when Ruth had made her covenant to Naomi, she had brought herself into something bigger than just her own desires. So, you see, in Israel, God had promised the land to all of the people. And the way it worked is, like generation to generation, that land would be passed down by the family name. So everyone's name would be remembered in Israel. That was kind of how it worked. And if a bit of land was sold out of the family, every 50 years there was the year of Jubilee where it would be brought back to the person it had originally been given to. And if someone died without an heir, they had systems so that an heir could be given to carry on that family line. Now, Naomi and Elimelech, they had no one to carry on their family line. But Ruth, by making her promise, has entered into this. So all the laws surrounding it apply to her. So I'll give you a couple of them. So Leviticus chapter 25, this is about redeeming the land. It says, if your brother becomes poor and sells part of his property, then his nearest redeemer shall come and redeem what his brother has sold. And then in Deuteronomy 25, this one's concerning the heirs. If brothers dwell together and one of them dies and has no son, the wife of the dead man shall not be married outside the family to a stranger. Her husband's brother shall go into her and take her as his wife and perform the duty of a husband's brother to her. And the first son who she bears shall succeed to the name of his dead brother, that his name may not be blotted out of Israel. So basically said, look, if your brother gets poor and sells his land as his brother, it's on you to buy it back and redeem it to his family. If your brother dies without an heir, as his brother, it's your job to produce an heir who can carry on his family line, who will take his name. And he says brother, but it was often interpreted as the closest male relative who had this. So if there was no brother, it would be an uncle or then a cousin or kind of whatever. Who was the closest male relative who could do this? And so the problem we've got here is that whilst Boaz was a relative of Elimelech, there was someone closer who primarily had this responsibility. Right, all of that's background. Let's read our verses. So, Ruth chapter 4. If you've got a Bible, please follow along. I'm going to read the first 12 verses here. Now Boaz had gone up to the gate and sat down there. And behold, the Redeemer of whom Boaz had spoken came by. So Boaz said, "Turn aside, friend. Sit down here." And he turned aside and sat down. He took 10 men of the elders of the city and said, "Sit down here." So they sat down. Then he said to the Redeemer, "Naomi, who has come back from the country of Moab, is selling the parcel of land that belonged to our relative Elimelech. So I thought I would tell you of it and say, buy it in the presence of those sitting here and in the presence of the elders of my people. If you will redeem it, redeem it. But if you will not, tell me that I may know. For there is no one besides you to redeem it, and I come after you." And he said, "I will redeem it." Then Boaz said, "The day you buy the field from the hand of Naomi, you also acquire Ruth the Moabite, the widow of the dead, in order to perpetuate the name of the dead in his inheritance." Then the Redeemer said, "I cannot redeem it for myself, lest I impair my own inheritance. Take my right of redemption yourself, for I cannot redeem it." Now this was the custom in former times in Israel concerning redeeming and exchanging. To confirm a transaction, one drew off his sandal and gave it to the other. And this was the manner of attesting in Israel. So when the Redeemer said to Boaz, "Buy it for yourself," he drew off his sandal. Then Boaz said to the elders and all the people, "You are witnesses this day that I have bought from the hand of Naomi all that belonged to Elimelech and all that belonged to Chilion and to Mahlon. Also Ruth the Moabite, the widow of Mahlon, I have bought to be my wife, to perpetuate the name of the dead in his inheritance, that the name of the dead may not be cut off from among his brothers and from the gate of his native place. You are witnesses this day." Then all the people who were at the gate and the elders said, "We are witnesses. May the Lord make the woman who is coming into your house like Rachel and Leah, who together built up the house of Israel. May you act worthily in Ephrathah and be renowned in Bethlehem. And may your house be like the house of Perez, whom Tamar bore to Judah, because of the offspring that the Lord will give you by this young woman." So do you see what happened there? So he's gone to the city gate. Now the gate was the place of business. So the elders of the city, the business people, that's where they would hang out. And if they needed to do deals, that's where they could find the people to do the deals with. They'd sit down, they'd get their witnesses, and it's like the contract would be signed and sealed in that place. Boaz goes there. He finds this other redeemer. He's completely above board. He just says to the guy, "Look, this is the situation. Do you want to step in?" He does what he's meant to do. He doesn't just go and marry Ruth on the sly. He's got integrity, but he's also a little bit savvy about it. I don't know if you noticed that. He kind of starts, he's like, "Look, there's some land. Do you want the land?" And this other guy's thinking, I get this. Boaz wants the land. The land must be valuable. Okay, cool. Yeah, I'll take the land. And it's like, "Oh, by the way, if you have the land, you've got to have Ruth as well, because you've acknowledged that you are the Redeemer. You have this responsibility." And so he thinks that Boaz is being pretty crafty. And he's like, "Oh, okay, having Ruth, that must be a bad thing. No, I don't want that." And so, okay, I'm out. So Boaz is like, "Fine, you're out, I'm in, I will do it." And he gets what he wants. And it's interesting, he's completely above board, but he's still pretty clever about how he does it. But there is a big difference between Boaz and this other redeemer. Because this other redeemer was only interested when he thought there was a profit in it for himself. When he thought, what can I get out of this. Oh, there might be a good field. Yeah, I'll take that and add it to my inheritance. When he thought it would be costly, he didn't want to know. Whereas for Boaz, he was all about this kind of hesed love, this loving kindness, this self-giving love. He didn't want it just for the land. He wanted Ruth. He wanted to be her redeemer. He wanted to be a guy who could take care of her and provide for her. Let's learn a bit from Boaz's example. I think there's two sides to Boaz's example in this story, thinking of him as a redeemer that I think are helpful for us. Because I see two ways that Boaz was a redeemer. He was a redeemer even before he ever met Ruth. Okay, we've learned about the guy and the way he was living his life. So the way he used the resources at his disposal, you know, he was running this field and he's just like, hey, when there's people kind of who don't have anything, just put extra stuff down so that they'll be all right. Make sure they're provided for. The way he used his time, even his relationships, we see the relationship that he had with his workers. Here was a guy who was living kind of in what you'd call a redemptive way. If God's interested in redeeming the whole world, which I believe he is, even though the laws about the land imply that, then the way we live in relation to the whole world is part of it. Boaz was doing that. But then secondly, the moment comes that there's a particular individual before him who needs redemption, and it's going to be costly to him. What is he going to do? And he chooses to lay down what would be his own best kind of financial practice and give and bear the cost of redemption. Those two things go together. Okay, you're not going to be doing the second unless you're doing the first. So how can we follow his example? I read an essay this week, and I want to read like an extended bit of it. This is by James K.A. Smith. He's talking about what does redemption look like, but he's particularly thinking about how we live in relationship to the world, okay, and God wanting to redeem all of creation. And I just found it quite interesting, quite fun, quite provocative. So let me just read a bit of it. He says, but what does redemption look like? For the most part, you will know it when you see it, because it looks like flourishing. It looks like a life well lived. It looks like the way things are supposed to be. It looks like a well-cultivated orchard laden with fruit produced by ancient roots. It looks like labor that builds the soul and brings delight. It looks like an aged husband and wife laughing uproariously with their great-grandchildren. It looks like a dancer stretching her body to its limit, embodying a stunning beauty in muscles and sinews rippling with devotion. It looks like the graduate student hunched over a microscope, exploring nooks and crannies of God's micro-creation, looking for ways to undo the curse. It looks like abundance for all. Redemption sounds like the surprising cadences of a Bach concerto, whose rhythm seems to expand the soul. It sounds like an office that hums with a sense of harmony and mission, punctuated by collaborative laughter. It sounds like the grunts and cries of a tennis player whose blistering serve and liquid forehand are enactments of things we couldn't have dreamed possible. It sounds like the questions of a third grader whose teacher loves her enough to elicit and make room for a sanctified curiosity about God's good world. It even sounds like the spirited argument of a young couple who are discerning just what it means for their marriage to be a friendship that pictures the community God desires and is. Redemption smells like the oaky teas of a Napa Chardonnay that births anticipation in our taste buds. It smells like soil under our nails after labouring over peonies and Gerber daisies. It smells like the steamy winter kitchen of a family together preparing for supper. It smells like the ancient wisdom of a book inherited from a grandfather, or that outside smell of a family dog in November. It smells like riding your bike to work on a foggy spring morning. It even smells like the salty pungence of hard work and that singular bouquet of odours that bathes the birth of a child. Redemption tastes like a fall harvest yielded through loving labour and attentive care for soil and plant. It tastes like a Thanksgiving turkey whose very turkiness comes to life from its own animal delight on a free range. It tastes like the delightful hoppy bitterness of an IPA shared with friends at the neighbourhood pub. It even tastes like eating your broccoli because your mother loves you enough to want you to eat well. Redemption can be spectacular and fabulous and almost triumphant. But for the most part, Spirit-empowered redemption looks like what Raymond Carver calls a small good thing. It looks like our everyday work done well out of love, in resonance with God's desire for his creation. So long as our on-the-ground labour is nested as part of a contribution to systems and structures of flourishing. It looks like doing our homework, making the kids' lunches for school, building with quality and a craftsman's devotion, and crafting a municipal budget that discerns what really matters and contributes to the common good. Of course, redemption is the fall of apartheid, but it's also the once impossible friendships forged in its aftermath. It's an open seat on the bus for everyone, but it's also getting to know my neighbours who differ from me. It's nothing short of trying to change the world. But it starts in our homes, our churches, our neighbourhoods, and our schools. Now, I found that pretty big. Because when I think about redemption, I don't think about many of those things. I don't think about the taste of good food. I don't think about kind of artistic expression. I don't think about going to the pub and having a good beer with my friends. But what he said is actually, it starts in everything. Every piece of our life can be lived in a manner that's asking the question, what is redemptive in God's world? And then when those moments come along, and look out for these moments that come along where you can particularly work to redeem an individual in need. Now, for Boaz, it was Ruth, a refugee who turned up from Moab with nothing at all. Who might it be for us? Who are the Ruths that we might be able to play this redemptive role for? Well, there are refugees in our land. Maybe it's those. Maybe it's people who've been sex trafficked, people who are in modern slavery, people who are slaves to addictions. You know, people who we can see a very specific need that we can lay down a cost. We can make a sacrifice to see them brought out of that mess that they're in. That's what Boaz does. And we can do that too. But of course, it will also be those who we encounter, the millions that we encounter in our city, who are lost in their sins and alienated from God. This is the biggest scale redemption of all. Talking about being redeemed but missing this kind of misses the heart of it. We need to see these people brought to God, and there will be a cost. And I know, okay, I've read theology books. I know Jesus paid the cost, okay? I hope you know that as well. Jesus absolutely paid the cost. And yet to see the person from where they're at being brought to Jesus, hearing about him, hearing the news of what he's done. You know, sometimes there's still a cost to pay, to bring them to the feet of the one who's paid the cost for them. Actually, the cost might be an awkward conversation in our place of work. It might be getting out of our comfort zone to speak to that person who we don't know that well, but we've got a hunch that if we told them the gospel, they'd be interested. It might be the cost of getting up early to pray for that person. But are we willing to bear a cost to see people redeemed? Boaz was. So that was the first redeemer. But you know, in Ruth chapter 4, Boaz is not the only redeemer that the story talks about. He was Ruth's redeemer, but there's also a redeemer for Naomi. Now, Naomi's situation, as we've talked about, she was kind of cut off from the inheritance. She needed there to be someone who could take over the land, who could provide for her in her old age. And Naomi's redeemer was not Boaz, okay? It was someone else, as we'll see. But the problem for Naomi is that she was too old to have any more kids, and the only line that she could have kids through now was Ruth. And as we've seen earlier, Ruth couldn't have kids. Ruth was barren. So we've got a bit of a problem. Naomi needs a miracle. That's what she needs. Let's pick up the story in verse 13. So Boaz took Ruth. She became his wife. He went into her, and the Lord gave her conception, and she bore a son. Then the women said to Naomi, "Blessed be the Lord, who has not left you this day without a redeemer. And may his name be renowned in Israel. He shall be to you a restorer of life and a nourisher of your old age. For your daughter-in-law who loves you, who is more to you than seven sons, has given birth to him." Then Naomi took the child and laid him on her lap and became his nurse. And the women of the neighborhood gave him a name, saying, "A son has been born to Naomi." They named him Obed. He was the father of Jesse, the father of David. I wonder if you noticed that it says in verse 14 that the Lord has not left you without a redeemer. And then in verse 15, that he has been born to you from your daughter-in-law. So who is Naomi's redeemer? It's not Boaz. It's this baby that was born through Boaz and Ruth. It's Obed. In verse 13, we're told actually it was the Lord who gave conception to Ruth. Now, here's a bit of a geeky fact about Ruth. There are only two times in the whole book that it says God did something. Okay? The first one was in chapter 1, verse 6, and it says, the Lord visited his people and gave them food. So there was a famine that God ended. And this is the other one, okay? The Lord gave conception to Ruth. There was a barrenness, and the Lord ended it. These are like bookends of the story. God has miraculously provided this child. And we get a sense in verse 17 that the kid is Naomi's kid. They're saying a son has been born to Naomi. That's a bit weird, isn't it? I thought they'd be saying a son's been born to Ruth and Boaz. But it seems that people are seeing this child as Naomi's child. And it says he will be a restorer of life to her, a nourisher of her in her old age. Now, earlier in the story, we saw that she got bitter. Okay, Naomi's life got hard, and she became bitter with God, with people, with everyone. It's like she'd given up, okay? She had no hope, she had no idea. But what do we do when we hit that moment? What do we do when it seems like there's nothing left, nowhere else left to go, and everything has gone against us? Do we give up hope? Well, this story should challenge us not to give up hope in those moments. It should challenge us to trust that God can do anything. God is the God of miracles. He's the God who can provide what seems impossible to us. But all of this is about something even bigger than Ruth, something even bigger than Boaz, something even bigger than Naomi. Let's finish the reading, verse 18. Now these are the generations of Perez. Perez fathered Hezron. Hezron fathered Ram. Ram fathered Amminadab. Amminadab fathered Nahshon. Nahshon fathered Salmon. Salmon fathered Boaz. Boaz fathered Obed. Obed fathered Jesse. And Jesse fathered David. Ruth started with these words, in the days when the judges ruled. That was a dark time in Israel's history. It was brutal. People didn't obey God. It said there was no king and everyone did as they saw fit. That was the context of the start of Ruth. The way the book ends is Boaz fathered Obed, Obed fathered Jesse, and Jesse fathered David. And what happened through David? Well, David was the king. And David was the king after God's own heart. And David saw things turned around in Israel. And actually, the land was peaceful and secure and prosperous. It's what you call the golden age of Israel was David's reign. And this story of Ruth and these events that God providentially worked through Naomi and Boaz and Ruth, it formed the bridge from the time of the judges to the time of David. So in one sense, we say the redeemer in this story is Boaz. But then we say, hey, there's another redeemer. It's Obed. And then we say, but maybe there's another redeemer hinted at here. And that's David, because he was the one who brought the land out of the mess. Now, you probably all know we're not going to stop there. We're not just going to say, okay, it's all fulfilled in David at the end. Because we know that the book of Ruth points us to the greatest redeemer of them all, the Lord Jesus Christ. I just wonder if you've got a Bible, would you just flick to Matthew chapter 1? Just kind of, if you can turn there, it would help. Because it's a list of names, and it's quite a long list of names. That's how Matthew starts his gospel. He's showing where Jesus came from. And you might see a few familiar names in there. So verse 5 says, Salmon, the father of Boaz by Rahab. Boaz, the father of Obed by Ruth. Obed, the father of Jesse. And Jesse, the father of David, the king. Jump down to verse 16. And Jacob, the father of Joseph, the husband of Mary, of whom Jesus was born, who is called Christ. So this family tree with Boaz and Ruth, and then Obed, and then Jesse, and then David, we can trace it all the way down to Jesus. In Galatians 4, it says, when the fullness of time had come, God sent forth his son, born of woman, born under the law, to redeem those who were under the law, so that we might receive adoption as sons. Think back to that crystal maze game, okay? We're the ones who were automatically locked in, okay? We broke the rules. We didn't complete the challenge. We failed drastically, okay? We've all sinned and fallen short of the glory of God. And there is a price to pay to set us free. And it's not just kind of some cheap plastic crystal thing, okay? For Jesus, it was his very blood. And he shed it on the cross to set us free and bring us out of the mess that we had made for ourselves. He is the ultimate redeemer. And the book of Ruth bridges the story to him. The way Matthew tells the genealogy, it's written in a beautiful way, because some names are in there that shouldn't be in there. And Ruth is one of them. Okay, Ruth's name should never be written in a New Testament genealogy. Okay, I'll give you a few reasons why. Okay, in those days, they didn't list women's names in genealogy. They traced everything through the male line. But Matthew, and God through Matthew is saying, but that's not how I see it. I see what Ruth has done as significant in this story. Actually, Ruth as well, she was foreign. She was from the outside. And God had brought her in and made something through her. And actually, Ruth, with several other women, there's a number of women listed in this genealogy. Tamar, Rahab, the wife of Uriah. All of them, in some sense, had some kind of brokenness about relationships, childbearing, marriage, sex, something like that in all of their stories. And yet, through all the scars that they're carrying, through all the brokenness, God has worked something beautiful and something incredible. That's what Christ's redemption is. You know, we were talking in community group this week about how if the cross is redemptive, then God can work through whatever the brokenness in our lives is. God can bring good through anything. When we started this site, someone shared a picture that God had given them of a guy who was like a street artist who took litter and turned it into art. And he said, this is a picture of what I think God wants to do through you guys. That actually there'll be people who feel like they've been thrown away, feel like they've been rejected, feel like they've been discarded and not wanted. But God will create, God will bring them together and make something beautiful out of them. And I think to an extent that's true of all of our lives. Actually, we all have a past, and it'll be different for each one of us, but there will be brokenness, and there'll be regret, and there'll be things that we look at and say, that's just not right. And we see God taking that and forming us into his image, into the image of his glorious Son at work in us. Maybe some of you see something of yourselves in Ruth's story, or in Naomi's story with the hurt or with the brokenness, whatever it might be. God would want to say to you, he's got a place for you. He wants to do something beautiful, even through your brokenness.